Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean Cosby is one of the best crime fiction writers working today. The acclaimed crime fiction writer Walter Mosley has said that Sean reinvented the American crime novel. Sean specializes in writing about people who we don't usually hear much about, the rural Black community. His work has become so popular that his publisher recently reissued a new edition of his debut novel, My Darkest Prayer. My Darkest Prayer focuses on a man named Nathan Waymaker. Nathan is a former Marine and Sheriff's deputy who now works at his cousin's funeral home. In the introduction to the reissue, Sean writes candidly about the fear he felt when he decided to write his first novel. He'd been writing short stories, and the idea of writing a novel was daunting. Fortunately for us, Sean overcame his self-doubt and wrote the powerful, suspenseful, and ultimately unforgettable My Darkest Prayer.
The biggest thing for me was I wanted to write a compelling long-form story. I had written a lot of short stories, had had some success with those, but I wasn't entirely confident that I had the chops, I guess, to write a long-form, a novel, basically. It was one of those things where I got into it, I realized it was infinitely more difficult than I had anticipated, but at the same time, it gave me the room to spread my wings, so to speak. I had been feeling stifled by the short story form, and so it was sort of this thing where I was afraid to do it, but once I did it, I felt so relieved because it allowed me to tell stories in much more detail than I had been able to previously.
Yeah, you mentioned it was infinitely more difficult to write when you started writing My Darkest Prayer. What was so difficult about it? Was it like the length that this being used to writing short stories, the length of the novel, was the thing that was most difficult about it?
I think the length, but in a different way. Writing a short story is a very consistent rhythm. Of my short stories are no more than 5,000 words. And so there's a specific tone and rhythm to a short story that you establish pretty quickly. I do anyway. I try to anyway. With a short story, you're basically playing one note, and to equate it to a musical metaphor. With a novel, it's a symphony. And so there were challenges maintaining the rhythm and the tone, changing the tone in different scenes and over the course of the book, creating a strong atmosphere. All those things were way more difficult in a novel than they were in a short story. But that being said, having the opportunity to be flexible with the tone, with the atmosphere, to delve into more complex and more nuanced character interactions was gratifying to me as a writer. It allowed me to really stretch my skill set and to give my characters a much richer background. So as difficult as I found it at times and as daunting as I found it at times, I also found it to be where I feel most comfortable today.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the action of My Darkest Prayer takes place in a funeral home. Why did you choose that location?
Well, I was actually working at a funeral home at the time. I was the overnight person on call. And so on nights that I didn't have to go make a call, or what we like to call a removal in a funeral home speak, I was writing. And I could tell you that job right up till Blacktop Wasteland came out. And so there is so much storytelling fodder, I guess is a good way of putting it, at funeral homes, because you're seeing people at the worst times of their life, but you get to learn a lot about folks as well. You also learn a lot about compassion and empathy and understanding. And so those are things that I really wanted to include in the book. And I've also used that in my writing as my career has continued, that empathizing with all the characters in my books, both the good and the bad guys and gals, I think allows the reader a more immersive experience in the worlds that I'm trying to create.
The protagonist of My Darkest Prayer is a guy named Nathan Waymaker. Can you tell us about Nathan?
Nathan is probably one of my favorite characters. I think if you asked me who's most like me in the characters I've created, I would probably say Nathan, because his sense of humor, his sort of sarcastic repartee that he has with mostly everybody he encounters, is very similar to myself, my own personality. Where Nathan differs from me is Nathan is an unmitigated badass. He can handle himself in multiple types of different situations. I don't think I rise to that level. I like for my characters, especially the tough guy characters, to not just be tough guys. I like for them to have a deep well of emotion to pull from. And you get to see what makes them tough. I think the idea of toughness, the idea of hard-boiled protagonists or noir protagonists, it can be sort of narrow. And I wanted Nathan to be more diverse than that. I wanted him to have more layers than that. And so I really tried to give him a really interesting backstory and a really interesting personality. And I hope I succeeded.
Oh, you definitely succeeded, in my opinion. Yeah, he has a very interesting backstory. And one of the interesting things is that he had once been a deputy, but he left the sheriff's office. Can you tell us about that? What happened?
Yeah, he was once a deputy and he resigned, as I say in the book, most vociferously. Basically what happened was, unfortunately, his parents were killed in an automobile accident by a drunk driver. And because the driver was the son of a very wealthy local businessman, the sheriff declined to press charges. And Nathan did not agree with that decision. And he got into a confrontation with a fellow deputy named Victor Culler, who sort of serves as his secondary antagonist during the course of the book. And in the course of Nathan resigning, he threw Victor through the window. And I use that story to sort of illustrate a lot of things about Nathan all at once. One, his sense of right and wrong. Also, that he is he has a temper and he has delved into ways to try to control that. I think the thing with Nathan that I really like that I was able to do was he's painfully self-aware of himself. He knows that he is not in a really good place mentally. He knows that there's some things that he is doing are not healthy, both physically and emotionally. And he's aware that he needs to work on those things. And he's aware in a way that I'm not, and a lot of people aren't. But I really worked to make him seem introspective and to make him seem like a character who is considering the consequences of his actions. That being said, I wouldn't be on the wrong side of him if he was ticked off. You could conceivably meet a person like Nathan. I hope that you don't ever have to meet a character like Bug from Blacktop Wasteland or a character like Ike or Buddy Lee from Razorblade Tears. But Nathan is somebody you could definitely have a beer with, I think. I don't know if you want to. You have a beer with them other characters, you might get shot at. So,
yeah. Yeah. Nathan's father was white and his mother was black. How does this shape the way he sees himself and how he views the world?
I think for me, and I have friends who are of biracial background, and a lot of times, especially in small towns, you have to make a decision when you're biracial. Or am I going to go with my mother's side of the family or my father's side of the family? And for Nathan, that decision was kind of made for him. What I was trying to bring to the table for him as a character was I wanted to have a character that had to straddle both worlds in this small town, his white side and his black side, as someone who has moved among both worlds and maybe felt like a stranger in both places. And that, I think, helps create or give Nathan this, you know, that outsider edge that most private eyes or characters who work in the private eye genre have. And because of his outsider status, he is the person who can see more clearly into what the town is and what the denizens of the town are. What someone outside of his life or outside of his circle might see as some maybe sort of millstone that he has to carry is really his superpower. It's his ability to look past the surface and to see what people really are like when they stop being polite. And I think that he gets that from his background.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Very well said. Your action scenes are so vivid and visceral. How are you able to write them so well?
I guess, you know what? The macho thing would be to say, well, I've had my share of bar fights and stuff like that. But really, it comes from, I was a theater kid and I was big, unblocking. When I was working in drama club in high school and college, you know, blocking and action and movement was really big. And so I sort of brought that same mentality to my action scenes. One thing I learned, and I learned this from a talk that Lee Chow gave. He breaks this rule all the time, but it's a very good rule to remember. He said, if your action scenes, if your fight scenes go on for more than two pages, they're not real fight scenes. And I took that to heart. I feel like in real life, violence is brutal and quick, and it almost happens before you understand what's going on. It's like a car accident. And so I really strive to make my fight scenes, my action scenes, no more than three pages at the most, because I think you start to lose the reader. And I think that's what Mr. Childs was saying. Watching an action scene like that in a movie, like, say, The Bourne Identity, is exhilarating. But reading an action scene like that, I think, is exhausting. And so I definitely try to compress my action scenes, get the most bang for my buck. Also, I used to do a lot of physical stuff. I used to wrestle in high school. I took Aikido for a few years. So I do have a little bit of a combat background, combining that with just what I consider, you know, a really strong narrative flow, I hope makes the action scenes compelling and exciting.
Oh, it definitely does. And I think, just to mention, you mentioned, I think it was The Bourne Identity, to watch the action scenes in that, it's exhilarating, but on the page, not so much. And I think that probably has to do with it. It demands more cognitive bandwidth, brain power from the reader, doesn't it? To keep track of all what's going on. Yeah,
definitely. Especially if you've got a fight scene where it's multiple attackers. Although, anybody who's ever been in a real life fight will tell you, multiple attackers don't wait one at a time to come after you. So just be aware that when you're reading the books, that's a little dramatic license that I think every writer takes, because, you know, in a real life fight, multiple attackers means you're going to lose. So
yeah. Thank you for those tips, Sean. You write very realistic and also very funny dialogue. How do you pull that off so well?
I think for me, I love listening to people talk, and I'm not eavesdropping. I'm really not. I love listening to the rhythm of conversations. One of the things that I missed on a visceral level during the pandemic was going to a bar with like a friend and having a beer and just sitting at the corner of the bar and listening to all the different conversations, listen to the ebb and flow, the rise and dip, the pitch of a conversation. And when I write my dialogue, I try to write the way people really talk. I have characters talk over each other. I have characters cut each other off. I have characters that will have a statement just sort of winnow out to nothing, or they'll meander through the course of the conversation. As far as the humor, I I grew up in a very humorous family, very quick-witted aunts and uncles. And so you had to be very... you had to be very sharp on your feet if you're going to hang around my house for, especially comes to mind, Thanksgiving. When I was a kid, the Thanksgiving dinners around my house were exuberant, because all my aunts and uncles like to pick on each other. They like to hurl very gentle insults at each other. And so that sort of fast paced raconteur style stuck with me. And so I bring it to my characters. And writing jokes when you're writing a book or a story is difficult, because there's nobody there to bounce them off of. And so you don't know if they're going to really land until you see, you know, the reviews, and then, oh, y'all got that joke. You got what I was saying.
Yeah. You have said that writing My Darkest Prayer convinced you that you could indeed write a book, and that you wouldn't be where you are today if it wasn't for that debut novel. So I'm wondering, where do you think you would be today if you had not written My Darkest Prayer?
Probably still working 60 hours a week at a hardware store. I think Darkest Prayer was not the book that I left my job to write, but it was the book that made me think I could leave this job. Without Darkest Prayer, without Nathan and Skunk and Walt and the whole crew, I don't think Black Tie Wasteland definitely wouldn't have happened. And I don't think Razorblade would have happened. I wouldn't have the opportunities that I've had. It just, you know, I got emotional writing that new introduction, because Nathan and Skunk and all that, those characters, they're like old friends. They were there as I said in the introduction, before the Halcyon days, before the Obama summer reading lists and all the awards. And, you know, those were the characters that I talked to as I, you know, sat in my my booth at my local coffee shop writing on my lunch break. And I can never repay those guys. And I mean that, you know, they're just like real people to me, and I can never repay them for what they've done for me.
That's great. Sean Cosby, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on My Darkest Prayer. We're looking forward to your fourth novel, All the Sinners Bleed, and hopefully we can have you back to talk about that book when it comes out.
Oh, thank you so much. I would love to do it, and thank you guys for having me.
Sean Cosby is the author of My Darkest Prayer. You can find out more about Sean and his work at wpr.org/beta.
Watching sexually objectifying media is correlated to a higher rate of sexual harassment and even sexual assault.
Coming up, filmmaker Nina Menkes talks about her powerful and provocative documentary, Brainwashed: Sex, Camera, Power. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.